Pour something flammable into your glass. It's Jaded Gamercast. My name is Lang. With me, as always, is Nathan. But again, with us here is a special guest, Gemma Noon, with Graham McNeil, who will be attending the Black Library Expo in Chestermere, Alberta on October 6th and 7th. It's only a month away. You should be getting your tickets, and we all already know that you have that day off, so don't fucking waste time. Welcome, both of you, Graham, Gemma.
Hello.
Hello.
I am drinking, because this is in the afternoon due to the time difference, I am drinking Coke with coconut vodka. Don't ask me why. It just happened. Nathan, what are you drinking tonight?
I was going to say, when we first started chatting, I had a Blanche de Chambly, but I finished it, so now I'm on to Bacon Maple Ale.
That's his subtle passive-aggressive way of saying Graham was late.
Yeah, massively late, and it's my fault. I'm now armed with a whole pint of Ribena, so...
Well, let's just all agree that it's Gemma's fault.
Oh, yeah, sorry, it's all me, my bad, I'm sorry.
Are you drinking as well, Gemma?
I'm afraid not, guys.
We are disappointed.
I know, but you're mean, and I just need to have all my senses about me to know when to shut my mouth and not try and engage you in an argument, which I will inevitably lose.
You have not listened to this show enough. It's not about winning and losing. It's about who talks louder and more often.
But I've talked with you long enough to know that I will lose if I haven't got complete control of my senses.
I'm good at what I do. Okay, so Gemma, tell us a little bit about the Black Library Expo. Any new developments, any new attractions that people can expect if they've kind of been on the fence about buying a ticket?
Okay. For those that have been living under a rock and don't know what the Expo is, we've got 8 Black Library authors coming over from the UK. Mr. McNeil is one of them. Dan Abner, Aaron Dembski-Bowden, James Swallow, Gav Thorpe et al. Are all coming over. So there's going to be seminars, there's going to be signings. There's also going to be 2 gaming tournaments on, one Warhammer 140K, which Nathan Pullen is obviously arranging. The big news I've had confirmed from Black Library is that we will have advanced copies of Pariah, and there will be knife fights over who gets them, because there's a limited number.
Not forget, though, Aaron has volunteered to run a live karaoke show on the day as well.
Oh, that's my game. That's my jam, son.
We are going to hold him to that as well.
Oh, just wait. Good. I'll be Barry Manilow in the shit out of that place.
Yeah, I think he's volunteered to do I Will Survive for the first number, just to get everybody started.
When you say volunteer, does he know that he's volunteered, or is he being volunteered?
He can't say no now. This is on the internet.
It's true when it's on the internet.
That's right.
Yeah,
guys, stop interrupting Gemma.
It's fine, I'm used to it. Aaron Dembski-Bowden will be hosting a karaoke competition.
That is going to get edited into a commercial, I promise you.
I'm the first person on stage. You heard it, Lang from Jaded Gamercast, if you know what the hell this podcast is. All right. So, where can we get tickets? Where can we get more information, Gemma?
More information is on the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Chestermere Expo, or from the website, which is chestermereexpo.ca. You can also grab your tickets there as well. Tickets are also available at Imaginary Worlds in Calgary, at Chestermere Library itself, and from the end of this week, they'll be available at Quantum Comics in Edmonton.
Wonderful. All right. So Nathan and I are obviously going. Graham and Gemma are obviously going. So you guys should definitely show up. This is one of those community things that we all need to support, get into, and make it happen. So let's get right into the interview.
Outside of UK Games Day, it's, as we said before, it's the biggest gathering of Black Library authors in the world. So, you know, if you're a fan of Black Library and writing in general and gaming, you are never, bar coming to the UK, going to get a better chance to meet the authors of the books you like.
Absolutely. I mean, we are stoked. And I mean, I heard even that there are people coming in from Texas. Is that right, Gemma?
There is. There's a couple coming up from Texas. They're currently the furthest out. We've got a couple coming up from Seattle as well, and from pretty much every province that I know of right now.
All right. So $20 per day, Saturday and Sunday. You cannot buy tickets at the door, chestermereexpo.ca. Let's get right into the interview here. Graham, we are absolutely ecstatic to have you on the show here. I've read a ton of your books. Nathan has read your books as well. And, you know, we're huge fans of even the stuff that you've done as a game designer.
Awesome. Awesome.
So let's get right into the questions here. This is the first question I have for you. As a past game designer for Games Workshop back in 4th edition, how do you feel about the current rules for the game? Do you still play in your free time?
I think the well the current sixth edition rules I think are just fantastic. I mean, it's a gorgeous looking rule book, and it makes the game that much more engaging. It's quick paced. It's you know, bang bang bang. It's sci-fi, shooty death kill in space on the tabletop, and that's what you want. To be honest, 40k wise, Warhammer wise, I don't play anywhere near as much as I'd like to. You know, I've got a little boy who's 3 and a little girl that's just turned 1, so my spare time is now in like negative equity. I have no time to do anything.
That gaming stock.
Yeah, exactly. I am now worthless as
you're currently in your Great Depression.
Yeah, I'm wandering the Dust Bowl at the moment somewhere. But I mean, I still, you know, to be fair, we still get our Wednesday, you know, our sort of semi-regularly Wednesday gaming groups thing. We've got some role playing going on there, board games if we can't get enough bodies to get the party together. But yeah, I don't get my toy soldiers out on the table and roll dice in anger nearly as much as I'd like to.
I would like to interject there. What's your favorite board game, Graham?
Arkham Horror is up there. I do like that, but sheer getting the play going and the excitement going, old school Robo Rally is one of my favorites.
Ooh, that's a fun one.
That's just great fun. You've got the cards there, and you suddenly think, yeah, this is great. I've got my move figured out. Then you suddenly realize, oh, fuck, I've got that one card at the beginning wrong. It's just screwed up my entire move. And yeah, you know, our gaming group is, you know, it's, you know, myself, Phil Kelly, Alessio Cavatore, and it was in its heyday, it was basically all games developers and guys from the studio and so on. So never a game would go by where we didn't tweak the rules at some point, rewrite a rule, change a rule or take it. And you know, the game, you know, you could for strategy forget that you weren't, you know, it's never going to happen because 2 moves down the road, the rules would change, the game would change, you know, the board would.
Well, I think that goes back to the conversation we had before we started recording about the fact that everybody here has kids and we're all trying to balance whether they're going to wake up midway through this podcast of like an hour. So gaming gets a little fuzzy.
Yeah, yes, it does indeed. But you know, that's the challenge. That just proves gives you the chance to prove how committed you are as a gamer if you can still find that half an hour to play a quick round of Talisman or, you know, quick half hour of Lunch Money or something.
You hear that, Nathan? That means I'm more committed a gamer than you are. Yeah, you'll said it.
Your kids are all older.
That's also very true. And I have 2, so it balances. What, Gemma?
That was an scornful laugh there, Nathan. Like,
Leg might feel that he has gamer cred, but he can't beat me in fantasy, so it's
well okay. I'm also not a hipster, and I beat you on the last game that we played. What? It's 1-0 because of the edition. Okay, so Graham, you were involved in designing the 3rd edition Necron Codex, and in Nightbringer you really gave the Necrons a little bit of extra depth where they had kind of been lacking at that time. Now it's kind of an older novel, so you know, it's one of those things where everything is kind of built up from there. What is your impression of the latest edition of the fluff for the Necrons in this last one, where they've become kind of more Egyptian? Like, do you feel like the things that you had done, the canon that you had created, has been changed or twisted, or do you feel like it's kind of just all part of, you know, this big group hive mind?
It's one of these things where, you know, you can't, whenever you're designing a codex, you know, certainly from the time that I came in, you could never be too precious about what you've done, because you know there'll be another edition along in a bunch of years that you probably won't get to write, or you're redoing a codex that somebody else has done previously. So you know, there's an element of, well, you know, I did my version for my time, and now this is the new time. You know, the version that myself, Phil, and Andy did was very much influenced by our love of Lovecraft, that the nameless dread old ones, and the fact that this is a host that couldn't be bargained with, reasoned with. You couldn't understand it. It was this ancient evil, and it was bigger than anything you can imagine. I mean, the new 40k incarnation of the Necrons is a far more personality driven one.
Yeah, I was going to say, because they really did tone the Catan down, especially. I said they really did tone the Catan down, especially in the sense where they became kind of this background figure as opposed to the way that you had written them.
Well, again, that's a legacy of possibly of what's been born out on the tabletop. The idea of, you know, the gods taking to the tabletop isn't the essence of what 40K is about as a game, as a tabletop game. So there's an argument for saying, yes, absolutely, they should be sort of scaled down a little bit the way that we wrote them was as these godlike, planet-killing individuals. So, that, yeah, there's an argument, a good argument for saying, yeah, they shouldn't actually be on the tabletop. Mm-hmm. But I love the idea that actually they are the, you know, material versions of gods and are still out there somewhere doing stuff and what have you. But I say, you know, the Necrons that scheme and rub their hands together as they plot, like, you know, the Grand Vizier kind of heir to them, it's not my favorite of Necrons. You know, if Necrons pop up again in my books, they won't be, you know, coming to the parley table with a, you know, "So, we have been expecting you, Mr. Marine."
Well, the chair turns around and they're slightly stroking a white cat.
That's a metal Tutankhamun beard. No, there won't be any of that. I mean,
well, that's what that was kind of leading into my next question there, is do you feel like that makes the Necrons easier to write into novels or a little bit harder now due to the somewhat hammy nature of their fluff?
Clearly it makes them easier to write into novels because, you know, before you had either the, you know, the page of Necron point of view text was all like 101, 101, 101, 101, or it was, you know, sort of really nebulous style of writing that didn't really get in the head of things, but it just kind of, sort of skirted the edges of it. Whereas this, the new Necrons allow you to write kind of text, dialogue for them, and give them, you know, motivations behind it. I mean, don't get me wrong, I know exactly why it's been done. You know, it differentiates them a little bit from more, say, from the something like the Tyranids, and it gives them reasons to be doing what they're doing, and it gives each one personality. And while, you know, like I say, while I can see why it's been done and all that, it's not the flavor of Necrons that I particularly like or was in favor of. But then it's not my decision, and like I say, you can't be too precious with it.
Well, and I think that leads back to the name of this podcast, which is Jaded Gamercast. So we're more than welcome to listen to you kind of say, like, that's not my Necrons. Like, I maybe wouldn't have gone in the direction of making them political idealists.
Well, you know, the direction that we took the Necrons in that particular codex isn't going to be the direction that other people are going to say, well, yeah, that's it. You know, my Necrons are like this and this. And that's, you know, when you choose to write about any particular thing in the 40K or Warhammer canon, you know, my take on it, my absolute individual take on it is not going to be the same as the guy next to me or the guy across the table from me. And that's fine. That's exactly how it should be, you know. But when I write something in my head, this is the only way it could possibly be and not be wrong. And but then everybody else's is just as valid. But then again, I'm writing it, so tough shit if you don't like it.
Yeah. Well, let me put it to you this way. I absolutely loved the third edition Necron Codex that you guys had put together because I really felt like that was where it was always this pinnacle of fluff and fiction and mystery and lore in the 40K universe. And I felt like it all kind of went away in the newest edition. So, I mean, I'm on your side 100%. Do you tend to feel a little bit annoyed when that kind of stuff flops on you, or do you really feel like it's just part of the environment and you just kind of shrug it off?
It's absolutely part of the deal. I mean, you know, certainly from where I'm standing now, you know, I write works in a shared fiction universe. That shared fiction universe comes down from Games Workshop, comes down from the studio. Huh. So, you know, if I do rant and rail about it, and you know, there have been instances when that's been the case, but that's kind of irrelevant because that's still the sandbox I need to work in.
I think it's interesting that you referred to it as shared fiction because I don't think I've ever really heard that type of a description before, but I think it makes a lot of sense in 40K and the fluff and the fiction and stuff like that.
It's absolutely shared because, you know, like Nick has written Ultramarines fiction, Gav has done Ultramarines fiction, Dan with No No Fear and so on. So, you know, as something I was saying to the editors a while back, is that although, yes, it is shared fiction, you know, none of the writers particularly have a you know, line in the sand saying this is, you know, my chapter, nobody else can touch it, back the hell off. Well, a line doesn't exist like that. You have to write as though it does. You know, I, you know, if I'm writing the Ultramarines, I'm writing as if these guys are my guys and what I say is law. Because if you don't have that level of belief and commitment in what you're setting up as their mythos and their lore, then it'll, by, you know, by definition, it'll come off as a little bit weedy.
So it really is that kind of ephemeral, in the moment type feeling when you're writing the stories that you're writing for Warhammer 40,000, or even when you're designing the codexes that you're designing for Warhammer 40,000.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, wonderful. So that kind of leads in a little bit toward... Oh, are we breaking up? I think we're breaking up. Nathan?
No, I was just laughing because you got the answer that it was almost like a Rush Limbaugh interview where he said like one word and you were just like, perfect, moving on.
That leads into my next question. That I think but that's just a testament to how great I am. Graham just laughs.
I mean, you know, I got the sense from coming from the beginning of that, I thought, yeah, that you were more or less on the same page I was about that one anyway.
Well, no, and I think that that's really interesting because, like, when you said shared fiction, I think that that was one of the things that I never really looked at it from that perspective, because I think we do this show so often, Nathan and I, where, you know, we're constantly bitching and complaining about the changes and the fluff, and we're always breaking down all this stuff and saying, like, God damn it, why do they suddenly have to have emotions and all these different kinds of things? It's actually very interesting to get that perspective from somebody who's on the ground floor saying, well, you know what, this is collaborative. Like, these are all things that we've put together.
You know, this is, you know, we all share the workspace. We all share the same work tools. You know, you can't go breaking one for somebody else. And if somebody else has done this as well, well, that's the way it is. And that's what I'm going to work with. And that then becomes the challenge of the writer, of games developer to, you know, to work with things that have changed and still make something brilliant.
So how much consideration do you put into that, you know, understanding that this will have to move on to other authors or other designers when you're actually writing it, you know, or is it very much just you're aware of what's come before, you're going to write exactly what you feel is missing in the lore?
I was just saying, if you're not writing something with the absolute conviction that the way you're doing it is the right way to do it, then you're not going to give it that level of authenticity to it. But yeah, absolutely. Always are very cognizant of what's come before. There's some characters in the chapters due that appeared in Nick's Battle for Black Reach and, you know, novella that went along with the previous edition starter set. And, you know, I made sure I spoke to Nick about them beforehand to say, right, well, you okay with me using these guys? And I made sure I read the book over and over again and just really got into my head who these guys were and what they were all about, so that when I came to actually write them, that they felt like the same characters.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's the one of the mantras we all have, certainly with the Heresy books, is that, you know, if something has appeared in print, we will do our absolute damnedest not to contradict it or not to fudge it, or, you know, if we can, or there isn't already contradictions, if it's there in print, then it's the background that we want to use, and we try desperately hard not to forget those or miss them and so on. So, and it's same with, you know, any other novel. If somebody's written something about, you know, the Ultramarines or vampires or the Bretonians or what have you, you don't certainly deliberately want to stomp all over what somebody else has done and said, well, you know, I didn't like that, so fuck you, I'm going to do my own thing. You know, that's just rude, because that's just leaving yourself open to somebody doing that to you. And it's just unprofessional to do that anyway. So, you know, you take cognizance of what's gone before, but as is what's coming, you know, yeah, you tell the story you want to tell and tell it the way you need to tell it. That's just the only way you can write.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, not to get too British on you, but brilliant. Right. Like, I really do feel like it's that part of fandom, you know, and having that respect for what's come before that really does keep things, you know, enjoyable all the way through.
Well, yeah, I mean, because the fans, especially genre fiction fans and Warhammer fans as well, you know, they are massive sticklers for the detail.
And, you know, that's quite an understatement.
Yeah, oh God, I mean, if it's, you know, you don't want, the last thing any writer wants is some guy, somebody coming up to them or actually more likely sending an email or posting in a forum saying, you know, I think you'll find that on page 25 of book X, so-and-so actually was like this, and you've said on page 55 of this book he was like that. Oh, Christ, you know, did I? Oh, yeah, okay. And, you know, it's right, people pick up on that, and I love that people do, because that shows a level of involvement and investment.
You're just describing Gemma.
Pretty much all of us. You know, because that's the thing, you know, that I think a lot of people, you know, when I speak to them at events and what have you, they suddenly click that, oh shit, yeah, you're a fan too. You know, and that's you know, I write these books, and but I'm not sitting in some, you know, otherworldly, isolated tower somewhere just putting this stuff out. You know, I'm there reading other books in fantasy and sci-fi and 40K and Warhammer and going, this is cool. How can I get an army for this? Even though I probably won't get a chance to play it for another 5 years. You know, I'm a fan of stuff too. So that's, you know, that's the level of involvement. And, you know, without that level of involvement of people really not wanting to pick you up on these things, but noticing these things, if you make those mistakes, is a great, because it's got that level of involvement from the fans. And it's great because it makes you really raise your game. It makes you say, right, I've got to do the you know, the books in the ground research for this. I've got to read all the stuff that's come before. I've got to make my notes, got to figure out my story, characters, and be, you know, respectful of what's come before and get the details sorted. I mean, I've got, you know, reams of like index cards and notebooks and what have you of characters through all the books. I mean, I've written like 26 novels now. Mm-hmm. Four or five different series or more, and yeah, trying to keep track of, does he have blonde hair or blue hair or green eyes or three horns or five?
You mean you don't have an Excel spreadsheet that's like listing all of the differences that you need to keep track of?
I've got scattered random notebooks with random notes scattered randomly and all over the place, so there is absolutely no system except just chaos.
Well,
it's,
I think,
there written somewhere. But
I think what's funny about it is you've kind of described that idea of like the difference between a fan and a reader, you know, is this idea that you do the research. You know, Nathan and I know that Gemma probably falls into this as well, considering the conversations that we've had about Doctor Who in the last hour. You know, there's a certain amount of research that nerds like us are very willing to do to make sure that we are right about the things we want to be right about, you know? And
that's
so blank. The fluff and the fiction.
If you're going to go on and tell somebody that I think you'll find, and then you better be goddamn right.
Well, mm-hmm. To be fair, if you're going to argue with Lang, you need to have your facts to back it
up. Gotta know your shit.
Or he will just be like, no, I'm right. It's wrong. I thought you're wrong.
Because yes, we were talking about River Song killing Rory, and you were saying, like, oh, she hasn't met Rory up to this point. And I was like, I don't know.
They were in the sewers, and people were trying to kill them, and everybody else was upstairs. So it was not like they first met like they did at Demon's Run episode. So I'm right and you're wrong.
Still doesn't make you right.
Yeah, it does.
All right, Graham. So, Nathan, anything to add?
No, I just love listening to you bicker with someone that isn't me for a change.
All right, so
target shifted.
I think if we don't talk about the Horus Heresy, I will literally be lynched. So let's get a little bit into some Horus Heresy conversation here. I have a question for you, Graham. When the initial idea was put forth by Black Library would be doing a longer collaborative book series regarding the Horus Heresy, what was your initial reaction to that? And kind of how did they approach you and other authors with regards to this very grand idea?
Well, my initial reaction was about bloody time.
Really?
Yeah, well, it's such a big story that it's been crying out to be done. But, you know, hard on the heels of about bloody time was the sort of correlator out of, actually, yeah, you know what? It's probably just about the right time to do it. because, you know, all of us, you know, all of us who've been writing for it and who will be writing for it in the future, you know, we were learning our craft, learning our trade along the way, you know, and, you know, hopefully learning and growing and getting better with every book to the point where I think we were at the stage to say, you know what, yeah, we can do this and we can do it justice and this is the right time to do it. As to how they approached me, that's 6 years ago. I mean, two children now, I can't remember what happened 6 minutes ago. I think it was an email saying, look, we're looking to, you know, I was in talking to probably Nick and Lindsay and Mark Gascoigne, who was the head of Black Library at the time, and they probably just said, look, you know, we're going to do this heresy stuff and we're going to have a meeting about it, so you should come in. Okay. I think it was a bit as, you know, it wasn't exactly a, you know, giant neon banner posted outside my house or anything like that, but it was, yeah, I remember thinking this could be interesting. And yeah, it was a very big meeting with Alan Merritt, the head of GW's intellectual property, and all the editors and a load of the writers all around this gigantic table in the boardroom in Games Workshop. And, you know, Alan Merritt sort of took us through. I mean, it's one of these things where you think, yeah, we all know the heresy story. And then Alan took us through the background, the whys, the wherefores, and then we suddenly realized, actually, you know what, we don't know this story. We know the upper centimeter of it, but there's kilometers of depth to this that even, you know, folk, there's a bunch of us who'd already, you know, who worked in the studio at this point, even we were all thinking, yeah, I didn't know any of that. And wow, that's just some great stuff there. So yeah, it was a big meeting, very informal, just lots of writers and editors and what have you, just throwing ideas around of how we could, you know, because it was going to be a different kind of storytelling, a different different way we were going to tell it. I mean, you know, that one thing I'm a firm believer of is that even if without a cover on it, within about two or three pages of picking the book up, if not before, you should know I'm reading a heresy book, not a 40K book.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it still has Marines and it still has the Emperor, and Horus is mentioned as a naughty boy, but the tone of the language, the style of the writing, you know you're in for something different just by the text, not even by the cover or the title or anything like that.
Well, and I'll be 100% honest with you. I'm about halfway through False Gods, which is hilarious because I was halfway through False Gods roughly 3 years ago. And I will blame this on my wife for the fact that she demands that I read a different book series. But, you know, it really does kind of seem interesting in that idea that, you know, you talk about it being about time. Like, what about the Horus Heresy and kind of this idea that, like, to me as a gamer and somebody who loves the lore, I look at it and say, well, you have to keep that lore mysterious. You have to keep it as mysterious as possible because that lets nerds like me obsess and freak out over what could have been or what might be, right? So,
yeah.
You know, like, what made you really feel like it's about time for us to move forward? Was it kind of the position that Black Library was in at the time for stories that they were telling, or just Games Workshop in the development that it was at?
Black Library at the time when we started was in a really good position to take that leap of faith that, you know, that the editors and writers could deliver something that would live up to, you know, the brand, for want of a better term, of the heresy. And I think we'd all felt that we were at the point in our own development as writers that we could do it and do it well. So I think that's the key part of it. Is, you know, it's the will was there to do it and the ability, I think.
Well, it definitely had grown to the point where that, you know, you were able to have a really collaborative effort, and I think the fruits of that have really shown. When I talked to a couple friends who listen to the show here in Alberta, who also are huge fans of the books that you have written, you know, when I told them, well, we might have, you know, Graham McNeil here on the show, they were very, very excited about just the idea of the Horus Heresy stuff. Where do you feel that you really excel in that collaborative process? Like, when you all sit down with the other writers that you're working with, like, do you feel like you're one cog in the machine, or do you feel like it really is just this massive brainstorming situation.
It's the way the meetings are set. I mean, it's a hugely. I mean, it's the shared universe plus one. You know, it's even more so because you know with 40K, you know, you can read the other books and you know other things. We do know a lot of you know we all kind of know each other even only very vaguely. And we can you know email or what have you, but the Heresy stuff we collaborate a lot on that, and not just at the meetings. I mean, between you know, we have maybe four meetings a year where we all gather at Black Library and just throw everything into the pot and just talk about the stuff we want to do, what we've done before, where it's all going, all that sort of stuff. But along the way to that, I'll send out, I've got a synopsis for this story I'm thinking of doing, or I've got this idea, what do you think? And it's, you know, it's, there's a lot of back and forth between the writers, either through emails or Skypes or, you know, if we run into each other at a workshop and so on. But on a project like this, where, you know, a lot of the events and characters are ones that are freely available and quite often do appear between different authors' books within a fairly short period of time, it demands that level of collaborativeness. And just by the very nature of the project, of the types of stories, the breadth of the stories, they you know they live and die by the collaboration or lack of, and I think so far you know we've kept on top of that because everybody does talk to each other a lot, and you know we make sure that we're all sort of roughly going in the same direction. You know there's all tangents here and there, but we all know the vibe of what we're doing and what it's coming to, and when we get together at workshop, you know we'll all. Everyone, we go around the table about, you know, what you're working on, Heresy-wise, what stuff you got coming up, what ideas are you throwing into the mix.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that on your blog a little bit, graham-mcneil.com. Your blog, you kind of talk about the times that you're sitting down with other authors and really kind of throwing ideas around and getting really excited about the things that you're doing.
Yeah, and it's great. And, you know, everybody just chucks in. And, you know, the morning sessions, usually I kind of like, what we're doing, what we got coming up, and ideas for that. And then Alan will come in the afternoon, and we'll swing by any points of contention or things we weren't sure about via him, because he's like the guy which everything has to be filtered through at the end of the day. And the afternoon sessions are the ones that are, for my money, the more fun. I mean, the whole day is fun, but the afternoons when we get to another level,
you get to nerd out.
It's just sort of the meta. Ideas of the Heresy, not just the specifics about this one particular plot or this one particular character, but you know the series as a whole, the meanings behind it, the themes and all that sort of stuff, and you know the big questions about it are come out in the afternoon, and you know everybody's pitching in, everybody's coming up with ideas and counter ideas, and there's always like a forest of hands going up there, sort of, ooh, 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 but if he does that, then we can do this with this, and ooh, ooh, ooh. It's everybody's just chucking their stuff in, and it's all bouncing off one another. And you know, the ideas you come away with. I mean, it's a rare. In fact, I don't think it's ever happened a Heresy day when I've come away from it and I've just had to either stop on the way home and just like get my computer out and just bash out some ideas I've had, or get the notes down in the paper right now, because if I don't, they'll lose it. You know, I'm always coming away inspired from it, of stuff that I want to do, and about another 10 projects onto the schedule now because of that. And you always get more out of it because there's always something that somebody else will see that you haven't seen, or they'll throw an idea into the mix that'll bounce off something you've thrown in and go give it another spin and go, oh, man, that's great. How did I not see that before? And I think every one of us comes away with more, like 10 times more ideas than when we came into the room. And even the ones we started with are, you know, they're now spit shined and polished and they've got new spikier edges. So it's a real fun day, real, you know, hothouse of ideas and creativity and just bouncing things around and seeing what fits and what's coolest.
So in that situation, and again, like any nerdy conversation, whether it was, you know, between Jem and Nathan and I before we started recording, how often are you just like, no, we can't do that? You know, like, is there a lot of contradictory ideas happening in that collaboration?
No, there's if anything's come up that we've had to go, no, it's because of something previously that's been written about in the books that we've, you know, there's what, worked about, what, 21 novels by now in the Heresy series, so, you know, that's a lot.
I was going to say, isn't Aaron bitter that he can't do his Navigator novel? Yeah, because it's like on about, I think he spoke to me about it as well at some point. Isn't he wanted to do a Navigator novel based in the Horus Heresy, like a Tale of Two Cities type thing, which personally, he still goes on about.
He's mentioned that, but whereabouts he is in it, or at all, I don't know.
From his version, it got shot down in flames. I just love the fact that you're like,
Juliet's sale novel rather than a Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah, it's. I just think it's great that like you're like Aaron's version is. It's terrible. It was shot down and everybody scorned him. And you're like, I vaguely remember that.
Well, but that's nerds, right? Like that's nerds in fandom. Is that we are all too eager to just absolutely cut you off as soon as you're remotely wrong about anything that has to do. You know, I think that Graham's right about that when he's talking about writing in the moment, but also being very respectful of the canon and things that have come before it. And when you're adding to canon, you know, having that knowledge of, you know, being aware that whatever you're adding to the canon can possibly change what's going on with it. Okay, so I have another question here for you. This is specifically from a fan of your book, specifically the Horus Heresy and pretty much the stuff that you've done here with Games Workshop. So this is from James. A lot of the newer Horus Heresy books have referenced the Lost Legions. Is this due to a formulated plan by you and the other writers, or is it something that's currently being kind of played by ear off the cuff?
Well, you know, the Lost Legions is one of those things where as much as we hint and what have you.
Well, it's the epitome of Warhammer lore. Like, it's the one, it's the thing that you should never get an answer to.
As much as we'll ever give, we'll take away with the next breath. So it's one of these things that, you know, it's as we were talking about earlier on, some mysteries are best left as mysteries. I mean, you can drop enough, you know, pebbles in the pond that ripple out, and hopefully that'll get people going, it could be this, it could be that. And then somebody across the forum will go, no, you're wrong, because it says on page X of this book that that's it. And then it just generates its own sort of self-perpetuating, you know, geek rumor fest, and that's brilliant. And that's exactly what you want to do, you know, to get people talking about the books, the stories, the mysteries generates interest. And it's not just something as cynical as that, but it's just fun to play with the ideas of what it might actually be, and the idea that we'll actually, you know, reveal something about it. Just, I can't see that anything we could reveal right now would live up to the 25 years of.
So what you're saying is you're just a giant cock tease? Is that all you're saying?
Essentially, yes.
Okay, so as a nerd, I can't let you off with an answer like that.
All down here now.
Sorry, what?
No, if you didn't catch that, it's probably for the best, and this best sanity of everybody preserved.
Okay, we'll leave it at that then. We don't know if it's planned or off the cuff. We'll just throw that out there.
Yeah, I mean, whatever you think it is, it probably is.
Hey, right on. I think that's actually a great answer. Okay, so let's talk a little bit. You've got a blog that you're currently writing. On your blog, you talk quite or at least recently, you're talking quite a bit about the collaborative work that you're doing with the other writers who are doing in the Horus Heresy, and that you're quite excited about the books that are coming along. What are you currently really excited to be working on for the future?
Well, at the moment, I just finished my novella that's going in the Mark of Calth anthology. So I'm just, you know, in the process of reading over that with the red pen of doom at the moment, and yeah, I'm really enjoying that. That's something which is always a good sign when you're reading back your own work, thinking, yeah, this is good. This is more nuclear bombs than I've ever had in a story before. This is good. So that's the latest Heresy thing I've done, and before that was Angel Exterminatus, the Iron Warriors, Emperor's Children Horus Heresy novel, which hopefully should be in print very soon, because it's been handed in and edited and within an inch of its life and is off to the printers. I'm doing my third in the Dark Waters trilogy for Arkham Horror. I'm starting that on Monday or Tuesday. Then
oh, really?
Off to do the. Yep, yeah, that's the well. The second book's out. If not now, then any minute now. And yeah, so getting the final book of the trilogy, The Dweller in the Deep, started this week coming, and then it's off to finish off the priests. Well, the Lords of Mars to finish Yay! Off the Martian ones that started not so long ago.
And can you ignore everything else and do that one first?
I would love to do that one immediately, but
please.
FFG have got they've got a head crusher in their head office. So,
well, I think Gemma makes a very important point here, and the point is that the Games Workshop / Black Library fans are the most important, and that you should give them priority and make sure that you are quenching that unquenchable thirst as soon as possible.
I did stray from the path, but this is my last one, I promise.
Wonderful. Okay, so anything right now that you're currently very excited about? Things that, you know, are kind of catching your attention, pop culture, anything? It doesn't have to do with 40K. Yeah, just well, stuff that you're really enjoying.
That's the thing I'm really looking forward to the most right now is going to see the new Dread movie.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
Because that's coming out next, I think it's actually out today, this weekend in the UK. And so, yeah, I'm already, pressuring Anita to say, get a babysitter, find a babysitter. We're going to see this movie. See it now.
See, my wife won't do it. She'll just tell me to go by myself or find one of my nerd friends to go with me. But, like, I love the idea that he's not taking his helmet off. They're going back to the comic book and they're not fucking up the way that the original Sylvester Stallone one fucked up.
I mean, that thing has been, to be fair, there was a lot to like in that film. I mean, as a whole, it didn't work, and as a whole, they missed the mark. But there was a lot of individual bits in that I thought were really good. So I've not got the same, hatred, apart from the Rob Schneider character.
I was just about to say.
Aside from that, I didn't have the same hatred for the film. Like, it didn't work, but hey, they tried, and God love them for that.
Well, before
it looks like they've totally nailed it. I mean, it's dark, it's gritty, the helmet stays on, he kills people in very bloody ways, and it just looks great. And just for the name Mama Madrigal, I want to go and see it, because I think that's just a piece of genius writing.
We all know that there's like a 65% chance that we're going to see Lena Headley's breasts again, but
to be fair, that's reason enough to go.
Why not? Nathan, was that what you were going to say?
No, I was just going to point out that the original Stallone one had more issues than just taking the helmet off. But
listen
to that punch.
The original Stallone one, and I mean, this is the highest praise that I can give to a bad movie, is the fact that if once a year it happens to be on television while I'm looking for something to watch on television, I'll typically watch it. And then remember why I shouldn't have watched it.
The thing about things like that, like, for example, just before I came into the kitchen to do the podcast, one of the Resident Evil movies was on. And by any sane method of measurement, those movies are dog shit.
Yeah.
But I still love watching them.
Yep.
Not just for Mila Jovovich.
You know what, Graham? My wife said the exact same thing. It was literally last night when I, on Netflix, pulled up the most recent Resident Evil movie, which I kept telling her over and over again was so bad. And it was roughly 15 minutes of me like tirading about how terrible this movie was and how they've ruined the canon of the movie universe, whatever you want to number it. As a comic book reader, we number all of our universes, but and she just said to me, well, why the fuck are you watching it? And I was just like, but it's so bad. I have to be reminded why I'm right.
No, it's got zombies, it's got chicks with machine guns, and regardless of whether you like it or not, it's still the stuff we like, whether it's done badly or not. I'll still watch a bad sci-fi movie over another movie because I love sci-fi. Which may be sort of slightly sadomasochistic, I'm not sure, but...
I was about to say, why would you watch the bad ones? Because that is the epitome of all that is bad with the genre. No. Why? There is a lot of good shit out there.
This is a thing, a friend of mine from Workshop we have a sort of semi-regular evening that we like to call Movie Babylon, where we try and find the most atrocious movies of all time and watch them, because the comedy you can get
Starship
out of
Troopers do.
Movies like that is just priceless. And as a almost like a training tool to see how easy it is for things to be done badly is a great way of not falling into those traps.
See, and that just shows that Gemma is a young nerd. She's not she's not actually reached that level. She hasn't lost her Padawan grade.
It's not that at all. It's being a librarian and having so much access to books, movies, etc., TV shows. I know that I physically do not have enough time to read or watch all of them.
The thing is, with a book, you have to have that much more investment. A film is like a couple of hours, two mates, some beers, and shooting the shit at television, and that's fun. And yeah, there is great sci-fi there, and I know there's...
I can understand you watching it once, and I can understand doing that, okay, apparently this is terrible, but watching it repeatedly is what I don't get. Like, one time, yeah, fair enough, but why... Like, if you'd seen Starship Troopers 2, why the fuck would you watch it four or five times?
Starship Troopers 2 more than once.
Oh,
see, and Lang obviously has. So
I used to write a blog called Virtual Inanity, where I basically tore movies apart, and it was my list of the absolute worst sci-fi movies directed at me as the target audience, where they were just terrible. And Starship Troopers was the worst movie ever made, as far as I'm concerned. But I've seen it three times because I can't help it. I understand it's neurotic, and I get that. Okay, I've been drinking. This is what's happening right now. So, you know, like, really, I agree with Graham here. Like, you have to be able to get into those things and appreciate how bad they are so that when you get into this kind of conversation, you can dictate things.
As the lead character says in that, was it Vanilla Sky, you know, without the bitter, the sweet ain't the sweet.
No, I just agree. I'm just going to win this one, but...
No, I love that Graham actually referenced Vanilla Sky, because I could talk for an hour about Vanilla Sky, but we're just not going to do that because I think Nathan would punch me the next time that he saw me.
I don't know. I've seen Vanilla Sky, so I could probably contribute.
That's awesome. All right, so I have one last question
That's
for you.
That's next episode, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, Vanilla Sky. It's all about Skyfire and the whole new rules and the errata. That's what's coming up next. We'll call it Vanilla Sky. Right? That works perfectly. That's almost kind of topical. But really, I've got one more question for you, Graham, before we kind of get into some rapid-fire kind of fun, goofy questions here. Not like this hasn't been already goofy enough. But really, from a fan's perspective, in Dead Sky, Black Sun, was there maybe a little nod to Star Wars in some of the quotes from certain characters?
Star Wars. I don't know. You'd need to remind me of that, because that was like 23 novels.
Well, there was
ago.
One point where the Raven Guard guy is saying, like, you know, attacking that fortress is not my idea of courage. It's more like suicide. And then there was another thing like, you know, hey Uriel, you're pretty good in a fight. You know, you and Pisanius should join me. And we had this very nerdy debate in the Games Workshop, because Nathan and I are both ex-Games Workshop employees, and Nathan had to sit through this begrudgingly for years.
I was also going to add, we're also huge Star Wars fans. I have two Star Wars tattoos.
I have one Star Wars tattoo at the moment. I'm probably getting a second one soon.
Well, it's entirely possible. I don't remember that offhand, because I haven't read or looked over Dead Sky Black Sun for... 8 or 9 years, probably.
Can you?
But yeah.
Can you just say that I'm right, so that I don't feel like a jackass?
Stop
validating him, Graham. Stop it. No.
Gemma has to live with him.
Most things that get into my books tend not to be movie lines or dialogue. They tend to be lyrics from heavy metal songs.
Oh Jesus!
Therefore, Lang was wrong.
Okay, I'm wrong. Fine. Gemma, have your cake.
Slayer lyric. Virtually every Space Hulk I've named has been named after a Slayer song.
That's wonderful. That is fantastic to know.
I absolutely love that idea.
The Savage Morticians in Dead Sky Black Sun are essentially, you know, almost a lot of their dialogue is riffing on Slayer songs.
That's awesome. Actually, you know what? Now that you say it, I can actually kind of see that in some of the stuff. All right, so let's get into a little bit of rapid fire here. Let's have a little bit of fun. What types of characters do you feel resonate most with readers? Bad guys or good guys? Ones.
The really nasty ones. They're the ones that everybody seems to... They're the ones that people always seem to talk to you about at events. About the ones who have the most horrible death or do the most despicable things.
So you're saying that gamers tend to identify with rapists and pedophiles more? No, I'm just fucking with you. Don't worry about it.
Especially past psychopaths, mostly, yes. I mean, that's only because us writers are probably borderline in that direction anyway and can write them so well.
There you go. See? And that's the outlet. That's what that is.
Yes, exactly. It's, I say, without books, we would probably all be mass murderers.
Yes, and you know what? I can't agree more, and that's why I keep guns under my pillow. No, I'm just kidding. Who is your favorite?
So you're not American.
No, well, I lived in Arizona for 15 years, so you know that I'm borderline. That's the truth right there. Who is your favorite and least favorite Primarch?
Off the back of Angel Exterminatus, Perturabo has become my favorite.
Yes.
Definitely my favorite.
Good choice.
Beforehand, we didn't really know much about him other than, you know, Bitter and Twisted TM. And I thought, that's not enough. That's not enough to hang a story around, because like, Angel Exterminatus more or less became his novel. And so I had to, you know, really develop him more than just that two words. So he rapidly became my favorite one, because even though he's a bad guy, he's a bad guy for what he sees as the right reasons. He's not somebody who fell by trying to do the right thing, but in a dodgy way. He embraced that evil, but still felt it was for the right reasons.
Right.
So I like that just twist in his character.
No, I agree. I love Perturbo.
His favorite Primarch's probably the Primarch of the 11th Legion.
Really? Why so?
Well, because he's a bit of a mystery.
So that's the reason why you don't like him? He's your least favorite because you don't know enough about him? You know that that's not going to sate the fans who are clamoring for that answer, right? Because they don't want to hear Sanguinius.
You'd ask me that before.
Well, we want to hear Sanguinius.
I personally want to hear Sanguinius.
You want me to badmouth someone? I need to have a think. Who am I missing or what have you? To be honest, before the heresy stuff, I could probably have given you an answer. Yeah, he's a bit of a pussy. He doesn't do very much or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But having had long discussions about each of the Primarchs and what they represent and how we can use them and so on, every single one of them has a really cool arc coming up or has happened or is ongoing and what have you. So I don't think I've got a least favorite one, which is probably not, you know, the bitch slapping answer that we need, but they've all really great stuff coming up.
All right, look forward to it. All right, so for you personally, as a writer, as somebody who is, trying to put their creativity, you know, into text onto paper, do you prefer fantasy or sci-fi? Because you've written quite a bit in both mediums.
Yeah. I dance merrily across genres and lines. I prefer the level of inventiveness that you can get in the sci-fi stuff. It is obviously quite freeing because you can pretty much, especially with the kind of universe that 40K is, given the eclectic nature of its initial founding and then what it's become, you can pretty much come up with anything and not have anyone say, well, that just wouldn't fit in 40K, because pretty much anything goes, and as long as you make it cool, then it's you can do what you want. So there's, on the one level, that's something I really enjoy, that freedom to do what you want. You know, the Warhammer stuff, certainly, because it's one world and it's, you know, these nations and what have you, as sort of, you know, so to speak, you know, you're a little less free in invention. But as far as the story archetypes go, I really love the actual day to day of writing. I prefer the fantasy style, because that's kind of the that was my springboard into wanting to be a writer, was reading fantasy stuff. And that those kind of stories are the ones that still have that sort of first resonance with me. I mean, with this, you know, sci-fi, you get that sort of joy of creation, of thinking, well, what about a story with this kind of thing in it that I've never thought of before, but that'd be fucking cool to get that in a story. So that you know, the actual day-to-day writing of it tends to be a lot, for me anyway, a lot trickier than writing for fantasy fiction. Just that for me, that just kind of rolls onto the page quite happily, because it's the language of writing a fantasy novel is very different from a 40K novel.
It's very open-ended.
And that language, I think, appeals to me more than the sci-fi language, whereas the creativity of 40K or sci-fi appeals more than, you know, what you've got in fantasy. So it swings and roundabouts, but then you keep it varied so that each one becomes just as interesting when you're working on it. You know, so you you don't want to do too many 40K novels or heresy novels in a row without getting back to, you know, wizards and dragons and swords and sorcery, because that freshens it up. And then when you come back to, you know, guns and spaceships and aliens, it's like, wow, cool, I get to play with these giant spaceships again.
Perfect. What Space Marine chapter that you have written for do you feel is the dumbest?
Sorry, say that again.
What Space Marine chapter that you have written for, like the various Space Marine chapters that you've written, I think there's like 5 specific Space Marine chapters, do you feel is the dumbest? Like they make dumb choices?
Dumb choices. Well, in terms of choices I wouldn't make, I'd go for probably the Emperor's Children.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they're not driven by the time they get to where I've taken them to at the moment, they're not driven by anything resembling sense. You know, it's all about indulgence. It's all about excess. It's all about, you know, me.
Like people who like War Machine.
Ooh.
Oh, God, that's Lang. That was Lang who said that. So you can rage at me.
Just for the record. Yes.
Just for the record, that was Lang.
Yeah, because they're not thinking like a chapter anymore. They're thinking as a bunch of individuals wanting to satisfy their own desires. So, you know, as far as dumb goes, I would say that's up there.
Wonderful. All right, so if you could turn back the clock on any literary choice that you've made in a past novel, what would it be? Like anything that you're looking back on and you say, you know what, after, you know, 2-3 years of looking at it, maybe I would have done something differently. You know, with experience, what would that be?
Well, I don't know. That's a tricky one, actually, because...
See, and that's what I'm hoping for, is to trip you up.
Choices, but...
Because you witty writers, you're always so on the spot.
I don't know. I'm trying to think if there's any... Are there any characters I've killed off? I think, no, actually, I wish I'd kept him around, because he'd have been cool to use for this book. I don't know.
So everybody, Graham McNeil, in his own mind, is infallible, like me, right, Nathan?
I know. I don't. I'm very much. If I had my books all in front of me, I'd go, oh yeah, I wouldn't have done that. And yeah, I'd have changed that one around or what have you. I can't think of anything offhand, but I'm sure I could. As soon as this call is finished, I'll be like, oh yeah, that, wouldn't have done that.
Well, you can just post that on our Jaded Gamercast Facebook page, and we'll all be able to see it as soon as it comes through.
I'm sure any forum that you would have a long list of things of what I should not have.
Oh, come on. You know how fans are. So here's the last question. Sorry, what's that?
What I'd like to do would be, I've taken the chapters due over 2 books and really properly get into the meat of an invasion of Ultramar. The book was already longer than, you know, was contracted for, but I'd still have loved to, you know, had another, you know, 75,000 words to really get the breadth of the conflict. You know, it's, I think for me, certainly, I don't think it's ever about what I wouldn't have done, more about what I would have liked to have done if I'd had the space or the time.
All right, cool. I like that. All right, so the last question that we have here for you, Graham, as we are starting to approach the end of our show, is in the Horus Heresy live-action movie, whom would you picture playing Horus?
Ooh, Peter Stormare.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that would probably not be on my list.
Every time I see him on the screen, he's just mesmerizing. I mean, he's not, you know, he's a funny looking guy. And I'm just going to say, obviously, and just recently we watched Constantine, where, you know, obviously he plays the devil.
You're right.
And I thought, awesome. That's because, you know, we all have a little bit of casting call for who you think would play one of your characters or your bunch of your characters in the novels and so on. And I've always pictured him as Horace.
Really?
He's not a massively handsome guy, but he's got incredible presence. And I think that's...
Well, when he's on screen, he grabs your attention. Doesn't matter who else is on screen, whether it's in Armageddon or it's in any other movie that the guy's been a part of. Like, he really does grab your attention anytime he's part of a conversation. And you know what? I think you might be right. I think that might be right on target for who would play Horace, because he is slightly charming in that sort of weird, mad way that he plays those roles.
Yeah, because, I mean, the Astartes are certainly, they're not pretty boys. I mean, leaving aside the Blood Angels. I could see, like Brad Pitt from Troy when he was playing Achilles. I could totally see that as Sanguinius. I think Horace is one of these guys because he's chiseled out of that. Are we still there?
Yep, we're here.
Still here. Sorry, I think Nathan Horace just left.
Sort of chiseled from the rock kind of character to him, that hard Chthonian nature to him, which, you know, he can turn on and off as and when he needs to. But yeah, and I think Peter Stormare has that too. He looks like he's got that kind of, I was raised in this bleak, barren industrial world, but I've still got that Primarch's charm of, you know, my genetic engineering has smoothed out some of my features of my human face to something bigger and, you know, crazier.
With fucking, like, blue gene remits in your forehead?
Yeah, exactly. And I think he'd be a great choice.
You know what? I'm going to have to side with you on that. I actually think that that's better than the choice that I originally had chosen.
Who did you have?
Oh, it was Willem Dafoe.
Oh, no.
Too skinny.
Really? You think it's just straight? Well, he's going to be in armor the whole time, so it's not like you can actually tell. Yeah, Willem Dafoe is such a good...
His face would be too skinny.
But exactly, he's such a good character actor. Like, he would put the weight on.
I was watching Spider-Man the other day there, and he was in there as Norman Osborn, and he is just all angles and lines and that.
Don't start bringing up Spider-Man movies around me, because that's a whole other conversation that we can spend another hour on.
So Vanilla Sky and then Spider-Man.
Evan was just Spider-Man, and so he was all over that.
Vanilla Sky and Spider-Man. I think Nathan has it right there. Okay, Graham, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I can't wait to meet you.
Yeah, thank you.
I can't wait to meet you at the Black Library Expo. If you don't have your tickets yet, get them.
Yeah. Well, apparently I'm the responsible one to have everybody's tickets, so God help them.
You're the adult, is what I hear.
Yeah, Graham's a designated adult. He has to have everybody's tickets to make sure they all get on the plane on time.
Wonderful.
Yeah, well, assuming I arrive at the airport on time. Or remember.
I was going to say, that sounds like herding cats.
Well, you know what? For four honestly, parents with children, I think this podcast went relatively well.
Yeah, actually, my little one's not been too noisy.
What's that, Graham?
Only because I forgot to get some alcohol in.
You forgot to get alcohol? I'm almost done with my bottle of vodka, coconut-flavored vodka, that. Don't judge me. But
nothing says manliness like coconut-flavored vodka.
Wow. I'm going to throw that back at you when I meet you on October 6th and 7th in Chestermere, Alberta.
Strawberry daiquiri in the bar, you can throw that back at me.
Well, strawberry daiquiri is the drink of choice for Sanguinius. And on that choice, that has been Jaded Gamercast for this week. My name is Lang.
I'm Nathan.
Hi, I'm Gemma.
And I'm Graham McNeil. I'll see you at the Black Library Chestermere Book Expo.
Wonderful. Have a good one.
Cheers.